Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Woj reported this morning that the Celtics have emerged as the front runner to sign Kemba Walker when free agency begins on Sunday. Now, this guy'd be a good fit for the Celtics offense. He would finally be surrounded with talent in a way that he has never been in Charlotte, and he would give Boston an immediate and reliable offensive weapon. Also, he's an addition to the locker room and not a subtraction. This guy's an energy giver, not an energy vampire. Unlike that one guy that Danny Ainge mentioned the other day, but would not mention by name. Here's the other thing about the possibility of Kemba Walker going to the Celtics. It means he will not be going to the Knicks. Yeah, but don't trip, Knicks fans. At least not yet, because they're being linked with a lot of other guys. You might not get Kemba, but you are still targeting Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, and Kawhi Leonard. Not only are they targeting these guys, but the legend, Charles Oakley, posted a pic with KD in New York with the caption, quote, "I see you out and about in my city, wishing at Easy Money Sniper a speedy recovery." All right, so when you see that, if you're a Knicks fan, you've got to be freaking out. I mean, are you kidding me? Kevin Durant in New York with Charles Oakley, a Knicks legend and a future Knicks legend? There is no way Oak isn't selling Durant on the Knicks and what it means to be a Knick, right? No way. Oh, wait. Yes, there is. There is a way. You know, the fact that James Dolan had Oakley put in handcuffs. Remember that? I know Oak does. Yeah, knowing that, I highly doubt that Oakley was doing a hard pitch for the Knicks. Yeah, come to New York, wear the jersey, play at Madison Square Garden, and then someday, you too can be arrested at MSG because the owner is a petulant child. Oh, and he fronts the worst band in the history of music. And if you even look at this guy the wrong way, much less tell him to sell his team and that his records suck, you'll be banned for life. Or worse yet, fitted for silver bracelets and then banned for life. So if you're the Warriors or you're the Clippers or any team not named the Knicks, the fact that Oak and KD were together is not bad news. In fact, it's great news. The best news. Because you know Oak is going to tell KD how he really feels about Dolan. Not that we don't already all know that. Hey, but you know what? I'm not here to be a big buzzkill, Knicks fans. Don't sweat it. I mean, I know you've been dreaming about Sunday, the start of free agency, ever since that Kristaps trade. But don't sweat the KD thing. There's still other guys out there. There's still Kyrie Irving. Kyrie still has this great reputation around the league, right? Actually, he doesn't. And what once seemed to be a foregone conclusion, that Kyrie was going to be a Knick, especially if you listen to Knick fans, is now dwindling as he reportedly becomes more and more interested in the Nets. All right, so that KD-Kyrie combo that was guaranteed by every Knicks fan ever when they traded Kristaps might not happen. But, you know me, Knicks fan, I'm a glasses half full cat. You're still going to be in the running for Kawhi. And you know what? You might really have a legitimate shot at that. You may have a really legitimate shot at Kawhi. Sure you don't. The Lakers thinking that they're going to sign Kawhi cannot believe how delusional Knicks fans are about Kawhi. Once again, you're going to tell me that Kawhi is going to leave San Antonio because of the relationship with that organization, then go to a spot in Toronto with one of the best organizations, but he's going to leave all that behind. An organization that was great with load management, an organization that put him in a place to win a world championship. He's going to leave all of that to go play for the Knicks. Aha, ha, ha, ha. Aha, ha, 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 ha. One of the worst organizations in sports with one of the worst owners. He's going to go there. Yeah, oh, okay. At least the Lakers are in SoCal. I mean, the Lakers may have a jacked up organization. They might have a dysfunctional organization. And nobody knows who's calling the shots. But at least Staples is near Riverside. At least Staples is near his fam. At least Staples is near his closest friends. The Knicks have a similarly dysfunctional organization, but everybody knows who's calling the shots, and it's nowhere near the 909. And don't try to sell me on the idea, as some Knicks honks have, that going to New York is going to be good for Kawhi's brand. Don't come in here with that take that Dennis Smith Jr.'s social media following grew by more than 50% when he arrived in New York. Yeah, you know Kawhi? Kawhi has tweeted four times. Four times. July 7th will be the fourth anniversary of his fourth tweet and his last tweet. You want to know how stale Kawhi's Twitter feed is? His second to last tweet is about a custom swag board. Do you even remember swag boards? That'd be like his second to last tweet being about pogs or slap bracelets. And not only that, check this. Dude follows only six other accounts. One of the six other accounts is the San Antonio Spurs. Like, the guy had the worst breakup ever with that team, but he still follows them on Twitter. Clearly, my guy does not remember he's even on Twitter. So I don't think that selling Kawhi on growing his Twitter followers is how you're going to get Kawhi, New York. Better yet, I don't think you're getting Kawhi. In fact, I know you're not getting Kawhi. Like, I don't know a single thing about Kawhi Leonard. I mean, after all, he is the most mysterious dude ever. But I know this. I know this much. He's not going to the Knicks. So where does that leave the Knicks? According to Mark Stein, the Knicks are also interested in DeMarcus Cousins. What's good, Boogie? There are also reports about the Knicks making a run at Terry Rozier and Bobby Portis and Julius Randle. You know, pretty much anybody who's ever picked up a basketball. How are the Knicks fans going to keep up with all those Photoshops? Man, they'll be burning the midnight oil all weekend long, hammering out one jersey after another. Here's the thing. Bottom line, the thing you have to be worried about if you're a Knicks fan, if you're already hearing about DeMarcus Cousins and Terry Rozier and Bobby Portis and Julius Randle, that does not bode well. If you're already hearing about certain guys as backup plans, that means the backup plans are about to become the plans. If you're hearing a report about a guy being an option, if they miss on their first option, they pretty much already missed on their first option. If you're a team that's linked with everyone, you're not signing anyone. This was supposed to be the summer of the Knicks. Listen to any Knicks fan, they will tell you that. This was the summer when everything changed. When the sleeping giant awoke. When the garden came to life. The superstars were going to line up outside the Mecca. And right now, it sure seems like this summer is going to be like every other summer that came before it. A complete whiff. Same as it ever was. Same as it ever was, Nick fan. I would love to tell you all that this is where everything changes, except that'd be the biggest lie ever. Nothing is changing. And from the looks of things, nothing ever will. But you still have James Dolan going for you, so that's nice. If the Knicks sucking and JD in the straight shot being even worse is inevitable, you may as well just sit back and enjoy it. I know I will. Dave Stewart joins me in studio. I said he is in studio. Stu, it's so good to see you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, man. It's always good to see you. Thanks for having me on.
It's good to have you, Stu, and it's always good to talk to you. Listen, I could start in any number of places, but as I mentioned, you're a member of the Negro League Baseball's Museum Hall of Game Class of 2019. It is an awesome class. I want to get to the other guys in a minute, but what does the honor in and of itself mean to you?
Well, and it for me, I mean, it all started with the Negro Leagues for you know, minority baseball players, black players. Jackie Robinson in particular opened the doors for us. And if you've ever been to the museum and had an opportunity to walk through the museum to hear the history of the museum by Bob Kendrick, who is the president of the museum, by the way, but if you listen to him tell the stories of the players that are in the Negro League, Josh Gibson, Jackie Robinson, Cool Papa Bell, and you hear the story, Satchel Paige, you hear the stories about these guys, it really gives you a feeling of pride to know what these guys were able to accomplish and how they were able to knock down the doors and get us into Major League Baseball. And so to be inducted with the class of guys that I'm being inducted with, which obviously you'll tell who those guys are. It's just amazing. It's a great honor, and I don't really have words to speak for how I feel about the induction.
Hey, look, we all love a night out, right? Whether it's checking out our favorite band in person or being there in the crowd to cheer on your favorite team, with Vivid Seats, you can attend the concert or the show or the sporting event of your choice, and you can do so at a great price. I love Vivid Seats. It is a top source for tickets for all live events that you want to go to. Great thing is, you can sort it by price, or you can look for seats in the section and the row of your choice. And most importantly, every purchase is backed by a 100% buyer guarantee. From the biggest concerts and games to the hottest theater and more, Vivid Seats has it all. So download their app or visit vividseats.com. Go ahead, make a memory that lasts a lifetime, and let Vivid Seats help you get to your favorite live event. Vivid Seats. Dave Stewart joining us. So in terms of the class itself, you, Eric Davis, Fred McGriff, Dave Parker, it's a hell of a group right there. When you look at those three guys, what kind of thoughts do you have?
Well, I played with Parker, and if you've ever played with Dave Parker, and I had an opportunity to play with him towards the end of his career, but he was still a very productive player. He's a great teammate, great leader, class cut up, if that's what you want to call him, had everybody in the clubhouse laughing. Fred McGriff should be a sure Hall of Famer, and that probably will happen for him, I hope, at some point. But competing against him and watching him accomplish the things that he did. And Eric Davis, every time I see him, which was just the other day over at the Urban Youth Academy, the first thing he talks about is a home run he hit off of me in Cincinnati game one of the World Series.
1990.
So, I mean, it's just an incredible group of guys that are deserving of being honored in that fashion at the museum. Guys that I competed against and enjoyed competing against, and just a great group of individuals.
We're talking to Dave Stewart. He is live in studio. Now, last year during the Players Weekend, CC Sabathia wore special cleats with the names of the Black Aces. That's the 15 African-American players who are 20-game winners. You and I have talked about CC in the past, and he talks frequently about what you mean to him. How much then did it mean to you to be on those cleats and be a part of that special group?
You know, this is the first I've heard of it. And I got to tell you what, it's just absolutely unbelievable. CC's been really, really good when my name comes up about the things that he's
felt. Check that out, Stu. Look at those things.
That is...
I'm not doing this for our TV audience, but if you see that, man, those things are awesome. Your name's on there. Doc Gooden's on there.
That's an unbelievable cleat. That is an unbelievable.
That's tight,
cleat.
Right? That is really nice.
Man, that is right on time. You know, so C has always been good when my name comes up or the topic comes up, my influence on him as a young man growing up. And I remember meeting him at the Boys and Girls Club out in Richmond. And little did I know years
later. How old was
he? 12 years old.
Right.
I'm telling my age. Little did I know he'd grow up to be, he's a Hall of Famer in waiting. And he's talked about my influence community, but as well as giving him the hope and dream that he'd be able to move on and become a major league pitcher and have success, and that's what he's doing.
Dave Stewart joining me in studio. Now, Stu, the pioneer of that club was the great Don Newcomb, another one of my favorites. He passed away in February. The story goes that when you showed up to the Dodgers big league camp, Nuke was there. What do you remember about the first time you met him, and what did he mean to you?
God, man, unless you've had an opportunity to be in Don Newcomb's presence, first thing that comes to mind on that day was how big of a man
he was. He was big, man.
He was a big man, broad shoulders. I'm just unbelievable. Now, Nuke always had on the best hats. And so he had on a nice white straw hat with a wine-colored ribbon around the top, and one of the best-dressed individuals that you'll ever see. He had on a what would be, I guess, qualified or classified as a Tommy Bahama shirt, nice collar, white slacks,
fresh,
white shoes with a little caramel-colored interior on the top of the loafer. Just a sharp-dressed man. And then the next thing came the advice that was most valuable and good for me, which is that this is a sport that you have to give all of your heart to, and you give your best to it. You play the game with passion. You play it with pride. And this game is to be taken personally. When you put on a Dodger uniform, you are the best of the best of anybody that's ever playing this game. This is a class organization. Their quality, they treat their players the best. He said, but more importantly, you as a black pitcher have a responsibility to go out and do your best every time that you're on the field, not just between the lines, but before you take the field, because the impressions that you leave will be impressions that you leave with others coming behind you.
Mm.
And I'll never forget that.
Amazing. Dave Stewart joining us. You're so right about it. He's a hard guy to explain. You need to spend some time with Don Newcomb to really understand his presence and the kind of man he was. I remember early in my career when I got my first TV show, he was one of the first guys in Los Angeles I interviewed, and old Nuke walked in. And by the way, I don't know if he knew me or not. Couldn't have been classier, but he was a presence, man. When he walked in that room, you felt it.
Unbelievable. Like I said, it's the height, the size of the man, the broad shoulders. And then the quality in how he dressed himself, and I mean, it was just, you felt like you were in front of royalty.
We're talking Dave Stewart in studio. So if he was royalty, like, where does that leave Sandy Koufax? All right, Sandy Koufax was a different dude altogether. Like, I don't know, Stu, that I've ever seen a major leaguer with that kind of it. Like, Sandy, first of all, he's just Sandy, and Sandy's like this mythical figure. What made him so unique? And as a young pitcher coming up, what was it like for you to chop it up with him?
Well, Sandy and I, in 1976, Instructional League of 1976, after two tough minor league seasons, I hadn't won a game. I was 0-5, I believe, or 0-6 in the first year in 75. And in the 76 season, I was 0-8. I had a hard time throwing strikes. It was just rough. And so in Instructional League 76, Sandy Koufax had the opportunity. I had the opportunity to work with Sandy Koufax. And Sandy had told me about his struggles early in his career with command and throwing strikes. And he told me, we're gonna just break it down. We're going to start you from square one. We're going to start with your balance point and your everything, your release point, getting yourself stressed out. And Sandy was the person that mentioned to me about lowering my sights, and I didn't know what he meant by that.
Yeah.
And so he said, you know, just try this. Lower your cap and see tell me what you see. And I said, he said, keep lowering it. So I lowered it to about right here. And, you know, now you're looking at the catcher. Basically, all you see is from the chest protector down. And that helped me to start throwing strikes. And so people have always asked me where that came from. Sandy Koufax was the inventor of that. So I go out the next year in Class A, Clinton, Iowa. I win 17 games there. They send me to AAA. I ended up winning another game there. I was 18-4 for the season. So Sandy was the most influential person for me when I was with the Dodgers, as far as performance was concerned. He had a way about himself of explaining things to you in a way that you could understand it. He put himself in a position that you can see that he had gone through difficulties before he became a Hall of Fame pitcher. And it was very, very helpful to me at that point in my career. I was 19 years old and trying to figure it out. You know, and as a young player in the minor leagues, you think that any moment you can be released if you're not performing and you're not putting up numbers. And he really helped me through that period of time. And now we fast forward. 1982, I was struggling out of the bullpen, not throwing very well, giving up runs. And Sandy says, hey, do you throw anything other than the four-seam fastball? I said, no. He says, I'm going to show you a two-seamer. And he showed me a two-seamer. But the two-seamer was pretty much a split. Now, Sandy's fingers, if you know him, if he shakes your hand, when he shakes your hand, his middle index finger is probably touching your shoulder.
Right.
He's got extremely long fingers. And so when he was showing me this two-seamer, which looked like a split to me, I did exactly what he did. And eventually, that's how I developed my forkball.
I was going to say, and then there's the forkball, right? So that's how you found that thing. The funny thing about the forkball, when you were in Texas, they didn't like that very much, right?
Oh,
so when you got
man.
To Oakland, what did Dave Duncan think about that pitch?
Well, Doug Rader gave me hell in Texas and told me I should put the pitch in my back pocket and never throw it again while he was managing. And so I put it away. But when I got to Oakland, you know, Dave Duncan immediately came to me after I started my first game against Roger Clemens for Tony La Russa and Dave Duncan. And in that game, I put the pitch on display. And then after that, Dave Duncan said that that is a pitch that's going to make you a winner. And that is a pitch that you should continue to use, and I encourage you to use it. And then my career took off.
Thanks for nothing, Doug Rader. Dave Stewart joining me in studio. Stu, Saturday, believe it or not, and I don't want to rub this in because you and I both know how this goes, but it's the 29th anniversary of that no-no. When you look back on that game, what do you remember the most?
I remember starting the game. Well, I remember my bullpen, which wasn't very good. It's the worst bullpen I've ever had, going into a starting game. And Dave Duncan saying, man, I hope you got smoke and mirrors out there because it's going to be a rough one for you. And I end up walking the first two guys that I face. And then after that, I remember Mark McGwire making a great play at first base, a stabbing play at first base to take away their first hit. And the next thing I remember was the last out of the game, Dave Henderson in center field. Calling Ricky Henderson off, making the catch, and the no-hitter being done.
Now, what a clubhouse that must have been. Hendu, Ricky, Mac, Jose. Unbelievable times. Hey, where do you come out on the idea of teams using, like, the game's different, the world's different, teams using openers instead of another starter?
Man, I've been...
You've been on both sides of this.
I've been killed so much about today's baseball from today's writers. And I don't understand... the purpose of an opener. Still, I don't understand it. You can give me any explanation. I don't know what the purpose is of an opener. You've got a five-man rotation almost always now. You know, I was in a period of time, if you had an off day, you skip that fifth guy and you go with four guys. Now you've got the fifth guy no matter what, and now you're involving a relief pitcher to start a game and pitch only one inning. I think it throws off the mentality of the starter. For that day that comes in after the opener. And I don't think these guys ever get in sync. The A's tried it against the Yankees in the one and only game they played in the playoffs last year. It was a failed effort. I just believe that there's more to the game than having a guy come in and start a game. That's a reliever is trained. His mentality is that of a reliever. A starter's is trained and his mentality is that of a starter. And so when you mix the two and you cross over, I don't think that it works.
All right, Stu, last thing. You, since you've played, you've been on both sides, as I mentioned. You were an agent. You were a GM. You've done a lot of different things. You are the CEO of Zen Relief Balm. Also, Chargers wide receiver, Keenan Allen's on the board as well. For those who don't know, when did you first get involved? And tell me about that product. What separates it from other products that are like it?
Well, 2 years ago, I got involved in the product. A good friend of mine, a good family friend of mine, Lloyd Lake, approached me about just helping with getting the name out, using my influence to help get the product started and running. And the product's been around for a long time. Lloyd's father, who was the inventor and founder of the Zen product, had talked to me about this years ago. His father passed, and the product kind of went dormant. Lloyd wanted to continue the legacy of his father. He came to me, and that's how I initially got involved. And since then, and even before I came on, we were in Rite Aid stores. And we've got some other small retailers. But now what makes the product different is it's a clean product. In this day and time when we've got so much crap out there, this is an all-natural product. It's got 15 essential oils there. It's clean. And on top of it, it works. I had a hip surgery 2 years ago, a hip replacement surgery 2 years ago. Never took a pain medication. After about a two-week period, I started using the Zen on the hip surgery or where the hip replacement was done. And literally, it went to work. I felt no pain. I started moving around better. I was starting to hit the golf ball about 3 to 4 weeks after the surgery. I got to be honest, if I had it when I was playing, though I had very few problems, shoulder, elbow. I mean, this is the perfect product for all of that. We've got a ladies line, and the difference in the ladies line and the men's line is obviously the ingredients. We've got coconut oil or lavender. We've got a men's line, we've got a sports line, and up and coming, we also got a hemp line that's soon to be on the market. And so in this day and time when you've got the opioid crisis and we've got different people depending on prescription drugs, I think that this is the perfect pain relief option for anybody, not just people my age. I'm 62 years old, but for young people that are involved in sports or your day-to-day household issues and things that you're doing around the house, this is the perfect answer.
Stu, you're not 62. I don't accept that. Dave Stewart, Dan, no, that's not, man. Just stop saying
brother.
That, man. Don't bring that around
62,
here.
62, brother.
He's a three-time World Series winner as a player. He is a member of the Negro League Baseball Museum Hall of Game Class of 2019. The CEO of Zen Relief Balm, as he points out, that is clean and that's healthy. Stu, it is so good to see you. I look forward to this every single year, and I appreciate you making the hump up here to do it in studio, man. Great to see
Jim,
you, Stu.
It's so good to see you. It's better to see you than it is on the radio.
Much
man.
Better. Much
it is
better.
So good
really
to
appreciate
see
you. You too. So back in February, the legendary five-time champ, three-time coach of the year, showed up at Oracle Arena for a night honoring the We Believe Warriors team of the 06-07 season. Part of that night included some media availability in which Nelly was extremely excited to volunteer. Because you have to understand, this guy showed up with this unbelievable look. Like, we've never seen Nelly like this. So people were eager to ask him, hey, man, how you living? What's going on? What's your post-NBA life like?
Can each of you talk briefly about what you've been doing after basketball? Coach, I know you live in Hawaii, right?
Yeah, I've been smoking some pot, actually. I'm doing that, and I'm having a pretty good time. It's more legal now than it's ever been.
Isn't that amazing? Like Don Nelson, one of the all-time greats, one of the legends of the game. What have you been doing? Smoking pot? And not even like vaguely or nebulously saying, I'm living the life. Man, I'm having a great time. I'm relaxing. I'm playing some golf, spending some time with the grandkids, or even like surfing. He went right to it. Hey, what are you guys doing? What's everybody up to? I'm smoking pot.
Yeah, I've been smoking
pot. I'm blazing. What are you doing? So if it sounded like he was happy to let the world know that he lives in Hawaii and burns tree, it's because he was really happy to let the world know he lives in Hawaii and he burns tree. But then again, my man earned it. But ever since he dropped that new addition to his Wikipedia page verbally, others have been more interested to get more information, and it's a good thing. News organizations trying to gather intel and have followed him to Maui to get the full scope of his retirement life. It's not a bad assignment, right? I wish somebody had said to me, hey, Rome, we need you to go to Maui to hang out with Nelly. But nobody did. However, the New York Times beat me to it. They were the first to dig in. And they found out that Nelly is not merely twisting Kron. He's also growing it. And he's got his own farm in his backyard where he's cultivated a custom strain called Nelly Kush. He told The Rag at the time, quote, I didn't think I'd ever be a pot smoker, but hanging out with Willie Nelson and Woody Harrelson and guys like that, you know, everybody smokes in my poker games. It's just become kind of natural. Usually you're smoking with your friends, sitting around, telling stories, you smoke a bowl, end quote. Add that to his resume. Five-time NBA champ, three-time coach of the year, Hall of Famer, and peer pressured into smoking dope by Willie Nelson and Woody Harrelson. So that was good, but there was more. Somebody had to get it. HBO made the trip. Brian Gumbel followed Don Nelson around for a couple of days and unearthed a couple of gems for an episode of Real Sports, which dropped this week. The only problem I'm having with the two clips is deciding which one I like better, which one's more amazing. Let's start with the Dro. Because if you thought that Don Nelson was growing pot, and by growing pot, I mean had a single plant and a heating lamp in a basement closet, or one like you had in your dorm room back in the day, then you don't know Don Nelson.
Retirement is good.
Yeah, retirement is good.
You got the farm.
I have a farm up there, yeah.
How 22 big a farm?
22 acres. We grow koa trees, flowers. We grow pot.
You smoke every day?
Oh, yeah.
Do your plants require a lot of attention up there on the farm?
Yeah, you got to treat it like a baby.
Really?
You got to water them. You got to have music for them. You got to bless them when you go in. It's a whole process, I'm telling you.
Damn. So not only does my man have a farm, he has a 22-acre farm. Not only does he smoke pot, he smokes pot every day. And what about the plants? He treats them like babies. He waters them. He plays music for them. He blesses them. He treats his kush better than you treat your kids. My man is out in Hawaii playing music for his plants and blessing them. So, the question on everybody's mind is, what kind of tunes do you bump for a cannabis plant? Unfortunately, that was not asked. But I'm just going to assume that Nelly pulls up a psychedelic space rock playlist on Spotify to set the mood. I also don't know what kind of a blessing a 50-year NBA lifer is giving to a pod of weed plants. Maybe he just reads the lyric sheet to Sweet Leaf by Black Sabbath, where a 26-year-old Ozzy Osbourne professes his undying and unconditional love for the lettuce. Or maybe, I mean, he is what he is, right? Maybe he coaches the plants up. I don't know. I have no idea. All I know is that Don Nelson is not just growing weed. He's out there on an island blessing his cabbage. Then there was the topic of that legendary poker game, which has featured many of his celebrity friends who stopped by Maui on vacation to play cards in Nelly's house, in Nelly's card room. And every great poker player who has a poker card room has got this. They've got the painting of their boys at their favorite table or their favorite game. I've seen this. I've seen this at other rich guys' houses. They do this. Poker players all do this. And he's no different. He's got a painting with his buddies who have played the game. And at one point during that episode of Real Sports, Nelly points to an unknown friend in the painting, and he tells Brian Gumbel who that guy is.
Well, this guy up here, he died in my poker room.
He didn't really die here.
He did. He died right there, right in front of us. And the guy said, what should we do, Nelly? I said, he would want you guys to play.
So you played around a dead guy?
We did.
Right, like, never mind the dead guy. Deal me in, Nelly. Where are my cards, Nelly? Everybody knows that aces and eights have been referred to for centuries as dead man's hand. I think the new definition of dead man's hand should be when you literally die at Don Nelson's house playing poker and the game continues around your lifeless body. You know, because he'd want us to. Kenny Rogers once crooned, you got to know when to hold him, know when to fold him, know when to walk away. The dude at Nelly's game literally folded. And they kept playing. Apparently a poker buddy croaking at the table was not the time for anybody to walk away either. Not if you had a good hand. Not period. Nelly said later in the interview that the game finally stopped when the mortician arrived. But until then, they were just dealing around the guy, the dead guy. Or so goes the story. And right now, the guy's, this is great. So where's the guy right now, right? Where was he laid to rest? Apparently in Nelly's home. And not only apparently in Nelly's home, but in one of Nelly's cigar tubes. Right now, the guy's ashes are being kept in a Cuban cigar tube that Nelly has hanging on his wall. So, in effect, the dead guy really never left that game. And, you know, like a fine bottle of wine, no, he's probably just waiting for the right time to fire up that cigar and smoke his deceased bro. Now, I don't really know why the family doesn't want the ashes. I mean, is there not a wife or kids or parents that are like, hey, dad or my beloved, dearly beloved husband croaked at Nelly's game? Can we please have the remains? Nope, we want Nelly to have them. We want Nelly to fire up that cigar one day. Man, I would love to be at that game when somebody's like, damn, Nelly, you are living the life, man. What is that, a Cohiba? Nah, man, that's Johnny. It's my man Johnny. He died here once. It's got to be some crazy, crazy strain that they're burning if they played right through a dead dude. Man, how good must that Nelly Kush be? Deal around him, boys. No reason to stop the fun, man. We're having a good night. Woody, Willie. Hey, can somebody please ante up for dead Johnny over there? Yo, Woody. Yo, Nelly. No, not me, Nelly. You, Nelly. Willie Nelson. You pay your taxes, Nelly? It's kind of like the NFL, right? Like when a dude suffers a catastrophic injury on the field, they wheel his ass off. They keep right on playing. Except in this case, they didn't wheel homeboy off. He was dead. They just left him there. Man, Nelly really is living the life. The life playing music and blessing his lettuce on the regular, playing through dead guys. He is living his absolute best life. Even in the presence of a guy who's no longer living at all. Damn, Nelly, keep on trucking. Keep on trucking, Nelly. Oh, and always remember, Nelly, gas, grass, or ass. No one rides for free, Nelly.
4th of July is right around the corner, so you want to prepare your vehicle for the 4th of July road trip right now by going to your local O'Reilly Auto Parts store. Simple preventative maintenance, like changing your oil and filter, topping off engine coolant, and checking belts and hoses, can avoid costly repairs in the future and keep you safe. The professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts have the parts that you need at guaranteed low prices. Get your vehicle ready for the 4th of July travel right now. O'Reilly Auto Parts, better parts, better prices every day. I'm talking about Ben Mezrich. Ben, what's up? How are you?
Hey, thanks so much for having me back.
Ben, it is very rare that I have a guest back this quickly, but so much has happened in the world of Bitcoin since you and I last spoke last month. First of all, what's the month been like for you, and what is the response to the book been?
I mean, it's been completely crazy. I don't know, Jim. I went on your show with Bitcoin Billionaires, and Bitcoin has gone up so much since then that I like to take credit for it, and you should too.
No, you should.
It's crazy. I mean, the world of Bitcoin has changed because Facebook suddenly launched their own or is announced their own cryptocurrency. The book has been just an incredible ride for me. It's been an incredible amount of press, and Bitcoin has exploded, you know, just in the past month. So it's been nuts. I've you know, I always try to guess when I'm writing a book about what's going to happen, but this was just a very odd coincidence that everything exploded right when the book came out.
Ben Mezrich joining us. Ben, it's been an amazing thing to watch, knowing you and knowing the book itself. Again, Ben, for people who are still trying to wrap their heads around it, because people still don't know, what exactly is Bitcoin or cryptocurrency?
So Bitcoin is digital money. It's money that you can send to someone like you send a text or an email. So I could send to you or to anybody Bitcoin instantly the same way I would send a text. So there's nobody in between. There's no authority. There's no bank. There's no government. It was originally founded by people with these libertarian, anarchistic ideals that it was completely free, and that it ended up being used a lot by drug dealers and criminals because it was untraceable. But now it's this whole new world where Bitcoin is becoming more and more part of the mainstream, and people look at it now like gold. It's scarce. There's only 21 million Bitcoins in existence, or will ever be in existence. So it's a limited supply, so the price is only based on the demand. So it's a way of money. It's pretty crazy.
It's wild. Ben Mezrich joining us. In terms of the ride itself, when you started to write Bitcoin Billionaires, Bitcoin was valued at about $4,000. When you and I, Ben, spoke on May 22nd, Bitcoin was in the 7,000s. Yesterday, it went right by 13,000, but then dropped roughly 1,000 in a matter of minutes. So it really has been a wild ride. And then something else happened. You touched on this in the last month, the announcement that Facebook wants to get into the currency game. You had referenced this before, but they did announce Libra. Before we get into the nuances of Libra, how insane is it that the twins launch a product called Gemini, and then Mark Zuckerberg comes out with Libra? I mean, there's no way that's a coincidence, right?
No. Mark Zuckerberg is the ultimate internet troll. It's completely insane. The Winklevoss twins, who are his mortal enemies, dive into Bitcoin. They make billions on Bitcoin, and then they launch something called Gemini and a Gemini dollar. And then suddenly, Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg launch Libra, which is a Libra dollar. And I actually ended Bitcoin Billionaires. The last chapter of it is Mark Zuckerberg contemplating launching a cryptocurrency. And I wrote this a year ago, and I had him doing this out of personal reasons, that he has this personal animosity towards the twins. He sees them thriving in this new economy, and he needs to get in. Now, obviously, there's more to it than that, but it's kind of wild that I picked this correctly, and I really do believe there's this personal psychodrama going on, and that's what Bitcoin Billionaires is about. Mark Zuckerberg can't leave it alone, and that gets into who he is. You know, back in college, he was a computer hacker. He hacked into all of the computers at Harvard, made a website where you could vote on who the hottest girl at Harvard was. That was what he did before launching Facebook. He was known as a computer hacker, so it's not surprising to me that he won't let this go and that he would do something that really does seem trollish.
Ben Mesrick joining us. He is the author of Bitcoin Billionaires. You want to get this book if you have not already. It's amazing. Now, you also, Ben, recently wrote a piece on Facebook and Libra, and you opened it with this quote. Quote, yeah, so if you ever need info about anyone at Harvard, just ask. I have over 4,000 emails, pictures, addresses, SMS. People just submitted it. I don't know why. They trust me, dumb bleeps, end quote. For those who do not know, who is that from and what's it say about that person?
I mean, listen, yeah, it's nuts. You know, that's an actual instant message that Mark Zuckerberg sent in college. This came out later during all of the depositions. It was actually not in the trial with the Winklevoss twins, but it came out later. But yeah, he thinks all of us are stupid for putting all of our data on Facebook. That was in his own words. And yet we continue to do it, and Facebook grows and grows and grows. So all the issues that Facebook is having, you know, is something that was foretold, you know, in the social network. But essentially, Zuckerberg, in his own words, basically thinks that we're all stupid for using Facebook.
So, Ben, like, for instance, what would you say to somebody who might say, yeah, but you know what, though, Ben? That was a long, long time ago. That was just Zuckerberg bragging about how successful he is. He's a different guy now. If somebody came at you with that, what would you say?
Well, listen, it's fair to say that he's changed a lot since he was 19. We all did stupid things when we were 19. But you look at Facebook's problems today, and all of the issues that we have with it, and you know, the fears we have around, you know, abuse of our data, of selling our data, of using it for weird political things, and you start to look back at who Zuckerberg is, and you wonder if this is something that, you know, has changed all that much. Listen, I don't want to, you know, trash on him too much. I really do think he's done an amazing thing, creating something that we all use. This is our lives now. We're all online, and that's partially because of him. But, you know, deep down, I think he thinks about privacy differently than we do. And we should all be a little scared of him launching a form of money that eventually we're all going to use.
That's what I was going to say next. Ben Mesrick joining us. His book is called Bitcoin Billionaires. It's out right now. I was going to ask that very question. I mean, leaving aside, Ben, the questions of how users without banks would be able to buy Libras, given what Zuckerberg has said and done as it relates to privacy, how much would you trust him when it comes to creating a currency?
I mean, it's terrifying, you know, but there's also positives to it. Everyone and their mother is suddenly going to have an electronic wallet. Everyone is going to get comfortable with the idea of using digital money. You know, we're all already comfortable, but right now we use things that use banks, like PayPal or Venmo. This is something slightly different in that there is no bank involved. In Facebook's, in Libra's case, it's going to be Facebook involved, but supposedly they're not going to have control over it, but they will be able to glean your data from it. Suddenly their tentacles will be in everything we pay for. So the amount of data that comes from the information from your bank account, it far surpasses the pictures and the things you put on Facebook right now. They're going to know what you buy, when you buy it, so it's a little scary. But at the same time, I fully admit we're all going to use it. Every one of us is going to buy something using Libra because it's going to be so simple. You're going to go on Facebook, you're going to see something, you're going to click a button, and you're going to have bought it, and no bank is going to be involved. And you're essentially going to be able to go to the store and buy Libra dollars the same way you would buy like an Amazon gift card. That's how you'll put cash into it without having a bank. So it's going to be really interesting. Everyone's going to use it, no matter what we say about it. But it's going to be completely unregulated. As you know, it's going to be something that these people like Zuckerberg and these other tech billionaires have access to the information from.
We're talking to Ben Mesrick. He is the author of Bitcoin Billionaires. You know, in part, Ben, you also just answered part of my next question. But leaving aside Libra for a moment, how radical is cryptocurrency?
cryptocurrency is one of the biggest changes that we're going to see, you know, via technology in a long time. I mean, Facebook was a massive sea change in the way we lived our lives. We now live almost entirely on the internet. And cryptocurrency is the money of the future. It's not controlled by any particular government. It's not controlled by any particular bank. The idea is I can send you money instantly and there's nobody between us. And I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, we're living in a world where we use our phones for everything. We're going to be paying for everything with our phones. No one's going to carry around wallets with cash in them anymore when everything is really simple and really online. And that's the future we're moving towards. And Bitcoin, in my opinion, is different in a lot of ways because Bitcoin really and truly doesn't have anyone in between it. There's no authority. There's no Facebook. If I send you a Bitcoin, nobody can get in between that transaction, and it's all guaranteed by math and science. So it's not something you have to trust. You don't have to trust Zuckerberg. But Libra is really going to change the game because it's massive. It's going to be immediately everywhere. And it's borderless. It's not just the United States. It's tied to everybody. So everyone everywhere, you can send $1 to someone in the middle of Africa instantly. And that's not possible before cryptocurrencies.
Ben Mesrick is joining us right now. Once again, that book is called Bitcoin Billionaires. Now, Ben, when you sat in studio a few weeks back, you said to me, do you have any Bitcoin? I said, no. And by the way, I do now, Ben, thanks to you. Well, not thanks to you, but when I asked you if you had some, you said, I don't. And I said, why not? And you said, look, it's still really speculative. It's risky. It could go right down to zero. There is risk involved. We know this. Everybody should know that. What are the kinds of things then, Ben, that you want to see before you feel like some of that risk is going to be diminished and it might become more stable?
Well, a couple of things going on. Number one, there are big whales like the Winklevoss twins who own enormous amounts of Bitcoin. So you're seeing these incredible, you know, peaks and valleys. In a single day, Bitcoin can go down $1,000 because one guy sells 5,000 Bitcoin. You know, the volume is still controlled to some extent by these giant whales who have billions of dollars in this currency. Remember, these guys bought it at $7 a coin. So for them, you know, it hits $10,000. They got to be thinking about selling a little bit, right? And so it's nerve-wracking in that respect. Secondly, I think it has to decide what it is. Is it currency that we use to buy something, or is it a store of value like gold or a stock that you buy to invest your money? Because the reality is I'm not going to use Bitcoin to buy a pack of gum if tomorrow Bitcoin is going to go up by 10%. I mean, that would be crazy, right? So right now you buy Bitcoin to hold it. The hodlers, they're called, the people who hold on to Bitcoin forever, because people like the Winklevoss twins believe the price of Bitcoin is going to go to $250,000 a coin. So they believe we're really in the infancy of Bitcoin. So, you know, it's not a bad thing to buy. You just have to be willing to take the risk. And not if you stare at the price of Bitcoin, as I'm sure a lot of people are doing right now, it's going to drive you insane. And it always goes back to that story of the guy. The first Bitcoin transaction was a guy who bought two pizzas for 10,000 Bitcoin. So at the time, it was worth nothing. And now those two pizzas are worth $1 billion.
Holy crap.
This guy, he's going to be found hanging in his bathroom. You know, how do you look at something like that and not be affected by it? So if you're watching the price volatility every day, it can drive you insane.
Ben Mesrick, my guest. Do the Winklevi, Ben, I mean, frankly, do they think that it's going to go to 250 gur, or does it behoove them to say things like that?
No, they are true believers. These are guys who bought in at $7 and held it to $20,000. And are holding it, you know, at 10,000, at 13,000, or whatever it's at 11,000 today. They're holding it because they truly believe it's gold. And gold is a multi-trillion dollar market. And Bitcoin is still a multi-billion dollar market. And so the idea is there's an awful lot of room to grow. And, you know, it's wild when you think about it. When Bitcoin started, it was so illegitimate. Everyone said, this is not real. Everyone said, this is a scam. This is a tulip bubble. This is crazy. Suddenly, Facebook is launching a cryptocurrency. So the legitimacy of cryptocurrencies, that has changed dramatically. It's now something that everyone agrees is part of our future. So the question becomes, does Bitcoin have a place in a world with Libra? I think it does as a form of gold. Why would you buy gold when you can buy Bitcoin? Gold is something that we don't know the amount of it is. I mean, tomorrow we could find an asteroid full of gold. We can change the amount of gold there is instantly, right? But Bitcoin is set at 21 million. And gold isn't useful. It's not like we put gold in jewelry because it's useful. It's shiny. That's all that gold has going for it. So the reality is, why would you choose gold over Bitcoin?
He is a jungle legend, and now you know why. He is a New York Times bestselling author. He has written a number of books, brilliant books, but this is really something. It's Bitcoin Billionaires, the true story of genius, betrayal, and redemption. The book is out right now. Again, it is killing it. Ben, I'm really happy for you. I couldn't be more proud of you. I love, Ben, from me to you as a friend, I love how much, I love how enthusiastic you are, how hard you're hitting this. You're not approaching this like, I did my book tour, I'm done, I'm going to go sit on a beach. Man, I know you are grinding. You are working really hard. You're having a great time, aren't you?
I am. You know, I love when I tell a story, I want as many people in the world to see it as possible because I really think these stories are important and fun and exciting. This is the origins of something that's going to change all of our lives. And I think that, you know, it's my job to get my story out there. So I really love doing it. And I love all the people who read it and tell me that they love it. And I think that that's just, it's literature is important. Stories are important. But they've got to be exciting and thrilling and life-changing. And I think that, you know, that's my goal every time I go out there. So I'll be pushing Bitcoin Billionaires until everyone's read it.
I'm here for it. I'm here for you, Ben. Also, you want to find Ben on Twitter. Ben is great on social. He's great on Twitter. He'll respond to you, clones. Find Ben Mesrick on Twitter and let him know what you think about the interview and the book. Ben, great to have you back. It's been an amazing ride, and I know you and I will get together again soon. Thanks so much, Ben.
Congrats. I'm always going to break my stories with you, so thank you so much. I appreciate it.
If you were listening yesterday, you know what I'm talking about. But if not, here's a short version of that phone call.
On day three, we got to a point on the river where we just couldn't go down. It was just too dangerous for me to, you know, have my girlfriend and my son go down. So to make a long story short, we put a message in a water bottle and just waited for the best thing to happen. And the best thing did happen. Two other people on the river actually got that water bottle, read the note, and 8 hours later, we had a chopper hovering above us at 12:30 at night.
So I tried to be nice about it because he was a nice enough fellow, but I called bullcrap. Nobody got saved by a message in a bottle. You're wasting my time. You're coming on this show. You're lying. And I said that just as a matter of fact. But you clones do what you clones do. You had a field day with it. But sure enough, Curtis comes back today via email and says it really did happen. I understand why you'd be skeptical, but it really did happen. And then I started thinking, man, I owe this guy an apology. But then I remembered what he said during the phone call, that he was rescued at night. And the video that he submitted to us was an airlift in the middle of the day. So again, I was skeptical. And here he is right now on the phones. So let's find out. I've had the email, the call yesterday, the email today, and now he's back for our questions. We go to Morro Bay. Curtis, it's good to have you back. Curtis, how are you?
Doing great, Jim. How are you?
My man, I'm great. I really, if I owe you an apology, I really want to give you that apology. But before I can apologize for the record, if you don't mind, I just need to answer. I need you to answer a few questions for me, if you don't mind.
You bet.
All right, so just a few questions. Let me start with this one. For instance, in yesterday's phone call, you said that you first heard a helicopter above you at 12:30 at night, but that rescue video is in broad daylight. There seems like there's an inconsistency there. I need you to explain that part of it.
I see where you're coming from, but what happened was search and rescue found us at night at 12:30, and then the CHP rescued us at 10 o'clock the next morning.
All right, so what happened? Why could they not do the rescue at night?
Because there was no place to land the chopper. As you saw in the video, they airlifted us out by a cable, and to do that at night would have been too dangerous.
So how are they communicating with you from the copter? Like, how did they tell you, listen, this is not safe right now, we see you, we'll come back tomorrow?
Well, they didn't actually say that. They didn't say that it wasn't safe enough. We found that out the next morning when we were talking to the CHP. But what they did when they showed up, they said, this is search and rescue, you have been found. And then they circled around us a number of times, and then they said, conserve your firewood. It might be until the morning till we are able to get you out. And all so we...
All right, so you knew that they could not do it right there. I was going to say, was there any part of you that was like, no, where are y'all going? We're here. But they made it clear, we can't do it. We'll come back. All right, so that's point number one. So that's where that inconsistency was. Now, what about the water bottle? Is it in your possession? How come we have not seen a photo of the bottle in question?
Actually, Search and Rescue has it. And so this lady, Cindy, who was the camp host, she gave it to Search and Rescue when they showed up at the Arroyo Seco campground, and Search and Rescue took the bottle. And it's in their possession now. I'm sure it's on a mantle somewhere in regards to, you know, everything going so well, and that's how it all went down.
So why do you think they would? I mean, did you ask them for the bottle? Did you try to get it back?
We weren't able to talk. Well, there was only one guy from the search and rescue when we got landed the next day. But Cindy, the camp host, was trying to get it for us the whole time. She thought it would make a great memento, but search and rescue just would not give it back.
Curtis in Morro Bay laying out his tale. All right, Curtis, the obvious question then, if there's video, then there's a phone. If there's a phone, it would stand to reason that you don't need a water bottle or a message in a bottle. Why did you not use your phone to call out for help?
I did. I used mine. My son used his. My girlfriend used hers, but there's no cell phone reception out there. We were hoping that maybe 911 might have some type of emergency connection or something, but there wasn't anything. And so that's why we weren't able to call out. There actually is no cell phone reception, even 5 miles closer to civilization when you're at the Arroyo Seco campground as well. We were using the camp host's landline to actually contact people in regards to letting people know what happened.
Curtis, what exactly did you write on that note, and who found that bottle?
You know, actually, the guys who found the bottle, they just, you know, got back to the campground as quickly as possible. They did it in about 3 hours, which I know would have been, you know, wasting no time. But they turned it into the camp host, and then they took off. They went home. And so there is the lady, Cindy, who got the message. She doesn't know who these guys were. And what was written on the note was that I just wrote that we're trapped at the waterfall, can't go any further, we're stuck, please send help. And then I dated it, so they knew it was actually that day.
I mean, this makes sense to me. Curtis, I'm almost there. It makes more sense to me. I'm starting to get closer to believing, and once I get to believing, then the apology will come. But I appreciate that. This is helping me. I just need to sit on this a little bit longer and kind of kick it around a little bit mentally.
Yeah. Well, it was a Nalgene water bottle. So there's a hard plastic water bottle. And so what I first was doing was carving it into a message into the bottle with a knife. I didn't know that we had pen and paper. And I yelled out to my girlfriend, do we have anything to write on? And she had said that she had brought in some pen and paper because we brought some just a deck of cards to play cards in the evening. And for whatever game we might be playing, just to keep score. And so that was the only reason why we had the pen and paper. And she was, you know, with it enough, I guess, or, you know, composed enough to remember that we had it. And so just found it and wrote the note. And
bro, it's a good thing. If you were, Curtis, if you were counting on carving your SOS into that bottle, I don't think you and I are having this conversation right now.
Exactly.
All right. Curtis, well, listen, what else? Before I let you go, is there anything else that we have not covered?
No, there isn't anything that we haven't covered. I mean, the only other thing was just that there's a lot of people knew that where we were, what we were doing. So it would only just been a matter of time before somebody would have notified the search and rescue. It basically just expedited everything, and it was just unfortunate that we had to be rescued.
No, I agree with that. But you submitted the video, so I've seen the video of your girlfriend being airlifted out, and now you've come on and told the story. It's certainly more plausible now. It's more feasible. Listen, my man, I appreciate you. I'm going to think about it a few more minutes, but you are close to getting an apology from me. Now, I would not hold your breath about one from the clones, but you may be getting one from me soon, all right?
Don't worry about it, Jim. You don't have to apologize. I enjoy listening to your show. It's been a pleasure to tell my story, and you know, I understand where you're coming from.
Good man. Wesley Woodyard is my guest. Wesley, good to have you back. How are you?
Jim, great to be back, man. Nobody gives an intro like you. My day's made now.
My man, me too. Now that you're back on My Day's Made too, you've had a really, really impressive career. You know, before we talk football, I do have to ask you though, Wesley, you had an extremely busy offseason like you always do, including the fact that you and your wife welcomed your fourth child. What has that been like so far?
Oh, man, I can thank you so much, man. It's been a huge, like, just a joy for the family and a blessing, man. My baby girl, Lane Lennox, is, you know, she's 2 months. She'll be 2 months in the 30s, so she's growing. The family loves her, man. It's just a beautiful thing.
Good for you. Congrats. Wesley Woodyard joining us. Now, when you and I talk in the offseason, in the past, normally it's at a time where you're coming right off the water to make the call. You've been doing some serious water skiing recently. Am I correct in thinking that you were out on the water with Grant Hill? Is that true? How did that come to be, if so? And who's the better water skier?
Oh man, well, you know what? Well, right now, I'm catching up to Grant. You know, he his daughter inspired everybody to take up skiing, man. And you know, he called me out. Well, actually, I called him out. Told him I was going to take over the lakes, and he sent me a video about 2 minutes long of him just skiing. So I was like, yep. This is serious now. You know, you challenge the Hall of Famer, you better come with it because he took it serious.
Wesley Woodyard joining us. You're right. I mean, you guys like that, they're competitive in everything they do. You guys are all like that. Tell me for a minute about lake life. For those who have not spent time on a lake, what do you like best about it? What is lake life like?
You know what, man? Honestly, man, I'm like a big nature kind of guy. You know, I grew up watching Crocodile Hunter, thinking I was Crocodile Hunter in LaGrange, Georgia, jumping on, you know, lizards, trying to catch rabbits and chickens, whatever you can catch. But man, it's kind of like the Animal Planet back here on the lake. You know, you see it. I've seen alligators a bunch of times, actually, right off my back of my dock. So man, it's like the Animal Planet. You see bald eagles, you see osprey eagles, you see owls, you see every little bit of thing, man. So it's cool. You know, catching up with nature and learning what's out there. But more importantly, man, I'm out there on that lake having fun, enjoying life. My kids are out there swimming. And it's a pretty cool feeling, man. I always wanted a lake house, but I never knew I would be living on a lake, man. It's kind of cool.
That's the best. Wesley Woodyard joining us. And as always, you're giving back. Your 16 Ways Foundation has had a number of events. And this weekend, your track club has a big state meet where you're going to have more than 30 kids competing. What's it like for you to see the track club taking off the way it has?
Man, you know, the track club has been doing this thing now. Honestly, that is actually how I kind of got my start, man. And you know, just really my technique and running through my co-founder of the foundation who runs our track club. Now it's in Michigan, but at the time it was in Georgia. And, you know, just the love and care and passion for track and helping kids succeed in life, man, it's been something that my cousin Derek has been on since day one. And they're getting ready to compete for the Junior Olympics. We had 38. Of our track members, you know, reach qualifying rounds, and 32 are going to be competing. The other six are, you know, they're taking a little family time. But man, it's just great to see that kids have something to do in the summer, and that they have people pushing them to be great, you know, and to be successful in life. And that's what it takes, man, and the kids, to these young kids today, just constantly, every day, all day, just continue to pour into these kids and show them that hey, it's a brighter future, whether that's through academics, athletics. Or, you know, a simple just to pick you up, man. And that's what our track club is about.
That's the best. Wesley Woodyard joining us. That is so important. That is critical. Now, you're entering your 12th year. You're 12 years in, and that's a long, long time to play in the NFL, especially if you're a linebacker. I'm not looking to put any time limits on you, but at one point, you talked to a friend, Keenan Burton, and he's another former Kentucky Wildcat.
Yep.
He got hurt, Wesley, early in his career. He never had a chance to play to his potential. What did he tell you when it comes to thinking about how long you want to play?
Man, you know what? Keenan actually checked me, man. My goal was to play 10 years. You know, that was something I was like, just make it to 10, make it to 10. That was something I used to always say, and I said it around him. And he was like, no, bro. He was like, you see how my career happened. And, you know, and Keenan, man, he loved the game of football, man. He was one of the competitors that I always competed with every day at the University of Kentucky. And to me, that is one of the reasons why I became a successful player for having a teammate like Keenan. But he was like, Wes, just challenge yourself, man, and go 15. And then, you know, take it from there. But he was like, man, don't shortchange yourself and say 10. You can play as long as you want to, as long as you stay healthy and you still love the game. And, man, I've just been blessed to have an inner circle that keeps me straight like that.
We're talking to Wesley Woodyard. You know, I want to ask you about another teammate, too. You and I have talked about your connection with Brian Dawkins in the past. I mean, the longer you're in the game, the more you know about the game. How much more do you respect the way Doc approached his craft and his game?
I've looked back at it. I mean, I'll be playing with probably about five or six, maybe Hall of Famers, man. And B-Dog was one of those guys that taught me every day is you got to live it like it's your last, Jack. You got to give it your all. And it's like, man, to see a man, a guy like that, just step up to the bat every day and go hard, man. This year, I'm going to have a chance to win this champ, Bailey being inducted into the Hall of Fame. So it's like, man, how can you sit here and learn from these guys? And to me, this is one of the reasons why I feel like I'm a good leader. I'm a great leader because I've learned from some of the greats, and you have to change this game, and that's what it's all about. So when a guy comes in the locker room, you know, I will hope that I would be one of those guys that he looks up to to give some of that advice, man, because I've seen a lot in 20 years, and I just want to pass it on to the younger generation and at the same time win these football games.
So, Wesley, do you think, like, in terms of Brian Dawkins, was he doing that with a lot of the younger guys and the younger generation, or did he take a particular interest in you? And if so, why do you think that was?
You know, I sit back and I ask myself that a lot, you know, but honestly, the caliber of man Brian is, he does it to everybody. Everybody is welcome to be around him. But, man, it's honestly intimidating to be around B-Dawk because you sit here and you stare at and watch a man that does everything the right way. And it's almost, it can be intimidating to some people to not be around him, not want to be good. But I was like, man, let me soak up anything I can learn from you, bro. And he just like my work ethic, and he saw every day I came in there to lead. I had a smile on my face no matter what happened. We was going to be in there, brothers. We were going to have fun. So that's what it's all about, man, that camaraderie of the game and being in the locker room with greats like that.
Wesley Woodyard joining us. Let me ask you about one more guy like Doc. Was it intimidating because of how great he was and how serious he was, or how much was just about his physical intimidation? I bring that up because, like, Champ Bailey. Like, Champ Bailey was your guy too, right? Was it intimidating to be around Champ Bailey?
Hey, okay, I'll tell you quick. It was intimidating to be around Champ because I seen this man catch 6 interceptions in practice one day, and it was like, what? And you're going to catch 2 of them with one hand? So his competitive level was just out of the water with Champ. But when it came to B-Dawk, he had it everything. He had a competitive speed. And then I tell you what, he'll sit here and stand in the weight room at the front door pumping the irons after a two-a-day practice, trying to just, come on, let's get it, let's go. So B-Dawk definitely had that intimidation factor. You walk in the locker room and you saw Weapons X locker, it's like, dang, that's B-Dawk. That's the aura of Brian Dawkins, man. And you know, I actually got a little piece of memorabilia from the locker, man. He gave me one of his helmets, so it's cool, man. That was a great experience in life right there.
Dude, I could just keep following you on this topic. It's amazing to me because in the NFL, an NFL locker room, there's nothing like it. I mean, you got alpha dogs everywhere across that room. How does one or two guys separate themselves from every other alpha?
Man, you know, honestly, just doing what you do. Like, you know, okay, there's some alpha dogs that don't have to say anything and that can move the crowd. There's some alpha dogs that has to bark and get everybody to move by. But the main thing is, whatever it is that you do, do it day in and day out. Don't try to switch up. Don't try to be this guy or don't be an up and down kind of guy. You got to stay competitive. You know, you got to challenge people. You got to come to work every day and work hard and want to be there and show your teammates, like, hey, you know, I want to be like you, or I want to do such and such this way just because I saw you do it. And I think, man, that's the challenge, and that's what separates the greats, man. Like, your Von Miller's, man, his locker was next to mine, too, and just to see the way that he's transitioned his whole thought process and mind process as far as taking on the league and the NFL as a businessman. And it's just great to see guys like that grow up around you and just play the game of football, because that's what it's all about. And the ones that stick around the longest are the ones that find themselves hanging with other alpha dogs.
Wesley Woodyard, my guest. So finally, Wesley, I mean, you have so much to bring to it, but when I look back, I mean, obviously you were undrafted out of Kentucky in 08, and here you are having this marvelous career. You're 12 years in. How do you explain that? How were you able to not only make it in, survive, but thrive that long, starting where you started? What's the key? What's the secret?
Bless, man. Jim, man, just, I'll tell you what, man. I heard something from one of my coaches, man, and it touched me. My high school coach, he was like, every year, you got to get better. And actually, he was like, man, Wes, you're getting better every year that you play football. And I think that's like a challenge for me, and it should be a challenge for everybody, too. Last year, you did this, but what can you do this year? What can you do more in the community? What can you do more on the football field? And I think those things tie in because, you know, there's this saying that's been going around in gyms where the only person that you, the only competitor that you need to compete with is yourself. And that's true every day. Like, every day you got to compete with that man in the mirror or that woman in the mirror and make yourself greater. And that's what it's all about.
Wesley Woodyard, linebacker for the Titans. He led them with 124 tackles last season. He is a three-time Walter Payton Man of the Year nominee while in Denver. He was the 2017 Titans recipient of the Walter Payton Man of the Year Award, and they're going to open it up against Cleveland. My man, I appreciate you. You know this. You come on all the time. Wesley, great to get caught up, man. Thanks so much.
All right, Gino. Talk to you later, man.
All right. This guy is in the East Bay and says he's in search and rescue. So he's got some insight to bring to it. Let's go to the East Bay. Chris. Hey, Chris, how are you?
Hey, Jim, how are you? I'm great.
Good, man, good. What's up?
So I got a lot of questions left that the layperson's not going to want to, or there's no know to ask this guy, Curtis, and I want to share those with you guys today.
Please,
all right.
Do it. Yeah, yeah.
So he gets discovered at 11:30, 12 a.m., and by some rescue team, and then he's left alone from the helo for 8 hours. I got a real problem with that, because where's that search and rescue team? Where'd they go? They didn't come down and medically evaluate them for hypothermia. They didn't come check this guy and make sure they didn't have any busted limbs or that, you know, that they're okay. They just up and leave and they're out. We'll see you at 8:30. Second thing, all search and rescue in the state of California is attached to law enforcement, and law enforcement has a lot of resources. So I'm a rescue team leader. I roll up on, you know, three soggy people at the bottom of a waterfall. I can't get down there safe with my team. Guess what I'm doing? I'm calling in the rope rescue team, and we're going to rappel down and pick these kids up. Let's say they're all healthy and they're all good. We can hike them out. So let's say someone's injured. I can't get them out. Where's the water resource? They came down by river, right? Where's the law enforcement sheriff's Zodiac with the outboard motor and the dudes in the helmets? Where's those guys? And again, okay, we'll see you later till 8:30. Hope you're all right. Hope you survived the night. No way. I'm just not buying this guy's story. They went right to the helo first? Come on.
All right, so Chris, what you're saying is making me question it all over again. What do you make, though, of the videotape that he produced? There's videotape of his girlfriend being airlifted out there the next morning or the next day. What do you make of that?
I'm an outdoorsman. I'm outside all the time. I hike a lot. I'm thinking to myself, how's that guy's cell phone made it 36 hours without going dead? Maybe he's good like me. Maybe he carries an extra battery, but I don't know, man. I don't know. It seems got there's a lot of holes on the search side. If you're in a traumatic situation, wouldn't you remember every excruciating detail? Where was, you know, I had these great rescuers. My rescuer's name was Bob, and he was there, and they took care of us. They kept me warm. You know, they gave me food. Where was all that? There's just a giant 8-hour gap between, hey, we found you, see you tomorrow. I just don't see it.
All right, Chris, I appreciate that. Let me respond because I'm running out of time. That helped me a lot. I really appreciate you calling. So that's a search and rescue guy, Chris in East Bay, saying, yeah, well, you asked some questions, Rome, but there are a few questions that you didn't ask. My man is dunking on Curtis's head right now. My man's dunking on Curtis and hanging from the rim and swinging from the rim.
Good night now!